Hello everyone, this is M.R. Rangaswamy with In Diaspora Radio. Today I'm joined by Bala Ambadi. Dr. Ambadi is an MD PhD who became the world's youngest doctor, and he received his medical degree at age 17. He is now rated as one of the number one of in the top 40 of global ophthalmologists. He works in Utah. He does eye surgery, specializing in lifestyle lens implants. But as you'll also find, he does a lot of giving back to the community and society. He's also looking at new cures for eye diseases. He, as I said, he volunteers a lot of time, as we'll find out. So, Bala, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Amar. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Super. So you've got this moniker of the world's youngest doctor. So take us through your childhood days. You know, when did you get the light bulb moment that said, gosh, I've got to go at a bright young age of 14 to be a doctor or whatever? So to just walk us through your early days looking at this profession.
Well, thank you. It's great to be on the program, and I've really gotten to enjoy knowing you over the last few months, MR. I want to first say, as far as my path to becoming a doctor at a young age, it really is due to God's grace and family support, and I could not have done this without the tremendous time and effort on the part of my parents and my brother. As far as the path, I started school at age six, like everybody, first grade. Mm-hmm. Within a couple of weeks, the teachers put me in second grade, and from that point on, it was pretty much doing 2 years of school every year, doing a combination of independent study and advanced classes and after school work to do challenge exams. So those kinds of things basically enabled me to finish elementary, middle, and high school, all 12 years within 6 years, and this was all at public schools in the U.S. And so I graduated high school at age 11, went on to NYU for my biology degree, which I was able to complete within 2 years. I had a lot of AP credit and prior college classes, so I was able to graduate college at 13, and I started medical school right after I had turned 14, and then medical school is 4 years, and graduated at the age of 17 in 1995.
Wow. And so when did you know you wanted to become a doctor?
I was burned on both of my legs when I was 4 years old. At that point, I was in the hospital for about 3 months. And I can't say that I knew I wanted to be a doctor when I was four, but that was a very formative experience. And just seeing what doctors and nurses did, I realized I wanted to do something where I could help people. And so that underlying thought, along with a lifelong interest in biology throughout school, it really came together in medicine, where it was intellectually stimulating and spiritually fulfilling in terms of being able to give back to people.
And how did you focus in on ophthalmology amongst all the different things you could have done?
So ophthalmology is a great field because you get to see patients of all ages. You have a mix of chronic diseases of all kinds of conditions affecting the eye, like diabetes or high blood pressure or lupus. You get to do exquisite surgery that's delicate and precise. And most importantly, what you do works. Normally we can fix things. Normally we can restore vision. And so it's a happy field. Patients really appreciate and value their vision. And nobody dies. So we have a great clinical mix. And then the opportunities for doing research and humanitarian work overseas are tremendous as well.
Fabulous, fabulous. So you must have been your parents' dream, because most Indian American parents and Indian parents dream their kid be a doctor or an engineer, and you did that in record time.
Thank you very much. I hope they're proud of me. Thank you.
Yeah. And so were they fully supportive? A few doing two grades a year and sending you off to college at a ripe young age of 11 or 12?
Was definitely a family effort. When I was in college, I went to NYU, and we lived in Queens, and I would take the subway into school. So I stayed at home during college. NYU was a commuter school at the time, and so that part was okay. But everything really, began with opening doors, and there was a lot of resistance from administrators and stuff because the school system is often afraid of change, and so the effort to knock on doors and open doors and allow these things to happen, that credit all goes to my mom and dad.
And so when you graduate, I know you had some challenges because at 17, you're still legally a minor, right? So how did that impact the state laws and stuff? Someone like you prescribing medicine or doing surgery or whatever, that must have been, so it took some doing at the state legislature from what I understand?
Yeah, so I was 17 years, 10 months when I graduated, and by the time I started seeing patients, there was a little bit of summer vacation right after you graduate medical school, so I did turn 18. But the New York State law for a medical license was 21.
Oh, okay.
And so we did have to get the New York State legislature to change that, and they changed it to 18. So at that point, I was able to prescribe morphine before I was legal to drink or anything else.
Wow. That is you must be one of these case studies for people looking at legal age limits and so forth, So did you actually have to go in to see legislatures and stuff like that, or
we met our state assemblyman. He sponsored a bill and did the lobbying, and we got a unanimous vote to change the law. It was pretty straightforward to do once the process started.
And, wow.
We got the pen that the governor used to sign it, so that was nice.
Oh my gosh, that is fantastic. So here you are, and an inspiration to so many, both Indian Americans and Americans and kids worldwide. My history is a little fuzzy, but you're probably better than this. Was the show Doogie Howser prior to you doing this? Or was that after your story came out?
I think I was around before Doogie Howser was.
Yeah.
I don't know that the show was based on me, but I was around before the show was on. I remember getting asked a lot about it throughout high school and college. So
I remember seeing a few episodes in the old days and going, wow, that seems like such a fantasy, but here you are. So looking back, Bala, do you think it was the right thing to do, in terms of your education and childhood, or would you kind of go, all my friends, man, they were enjoying life and taking it one year at a time, and I was doubling down, and any issues there?
No real regrets. If I had to do things over, I'd pretty much do things the same way. I really feel like what I gained in terms of being able to meet a lot of cool people and work with tremendous people in their field, having friends my own age and older than me, and the ultimate gift of time, I think all of those things really just are so much more than anything that I could have lost. Sure, I didn't drink or smoke marijuana in college or go to frat parties or anything like that, but at the end of the day, I think that stuff is very transient and not really that important. And I think focusing on academics and going at the pace that I wanted to do that was right for me, that kept me challenged, I think that was really good. Because I know a lot of smart kids who get bored in school just going through the traditional factory line approach in school. And I think that's really sad because when the idle hands, the devil's workshop, right? So
yeah,
a lot of smart people who just tune out and then you know, the school doesn't offer anything for them substantially, I think, you know, they can go down a wrong path.
Yeah. So how was it working with college professors at such a young age, and any challenges in terms of just dealing with, you know, your teachers, your peer group in college? I know you and I were recently in Mumbai at Ink Talks, and you had a pretty cool story of a professor saying, you know, that there were kids in his class of age 14 to 30 or something.
Right. yeah. The good thing was I was always tall for my age. When I was in medical school, when I started, I was 5'10", so I was pretty tall. On the first day of school, the dean announced that there was a wide age range in the class. The oldest student was 35 and the youngest was 14. So there was the hunt was on for the little kid. Fortunately, people didn't really recognize me right off the bat, and so I tried to blend in and carry myself as older. Even a month later, people would come up to me and ask, have you met the 14-year-old yet? So, I said no. With teachers and stuff, professors were nice, and, you know, even with patients, you know, you start your clinical rotations in third year, and so at that point I was 16 in third year of medical school, and you know, when you're an 80-year-old patient, whether your medical student's 24 or 16, they're still a kid to you. You know? So.
That's true. That's where they go. How long have you been working, Sonny?
Exactly. Right.
No, this is a fascinating conversation, Bala. Don't go away. We'll be right back after a short break. Great, thanks. Hello again, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora Radio. We are here with Dr. Bala Ambati, MD, PhD. He's an associate professor of ophthalmology and visual sciences, and is a director of the Corneal Research Lab at the University of Utah School of Medicine. So, Bala, welcome back.
Thank you.
So here you are. You graduate. You got an MD, PhD. You're practicing at age 18. What was your career path like since then? So you're 18. You're practicing. Where did you get started, and how did you come to Utah?
So after medical school, you do have to do residency first. So I actually did residency in internal medicine at Beth Israel in New York, and then residency in ophthalmology at Harvard. And after Boston, I went to fellowship training in cornea at Duke. And so I finished all of my medical training, I guess, by the time I was 25, and that's when I was a full-fledged physician attending. And I took my first job in Georgia at the Medical College of Georgia, where I practiced for 5 years. And it came to Salt Lake City in almost 8 years ago now, in early 2008, really for the job. It was a great place to be with a wonderful boss and outstanding colleagues. It really is one of the best places to practice ophthalmology and do research, and so that's what motivated me to come out to Utah.
Fantastic. So I know you've been in New York and Boston and so forth, so looks like you found your place in Utah. And how did you get into looking at working in India, giving back to, let's say, where your parents came from? I mean, take us through that journey of finding, you know, gratification and giving back to society.
So in my field, in ophthalmology, there's a lot of need around the world. In the U.S., there's one ophthalmologist for 16,000 people. In India, it's one ophthalmologist for 50,000 people. In a place like Zambia, it's one ophthalmologist for 1 million or 2 million people. And What that translates into is a tremendous number of patients who don't have access to restoring vision, such as cataract surgery or cornea transplants, which are routine in the United States and the West, but around the world, there's just not enough doctors. And so globally, there's about 40 million people who are blind in both eyes, a lot of which is cataract, which is a simple procedure, you know, 10, 20 minutes to take care of. The second leading cause of blindness is cornea disease, where the front window of the eye, the cornea, gets damaged, and doing a cornea transplant usually works very well. That both those areas are things that I learned and trained in and specialized in within ophthalmology, both cataract surgery and cornea surgery. So I definitely wanted to integrate service and outreach into my life. And so I work with several different organizations around the world, nonprofits that sponsor and perform a free cataract surgery or cornea surgery. The most common organization I work with is Orbis, which has a flying eye hospital. They have a DC-10 with an eye operating room on board. And so with them, I've been able to go to India, Zambia and Ghana and Malaysia and Philippines. Within India, I've worked with Sight for the Sightless in Pune and Project Hope in Vijayawada. And so on average, I'd say I spend a couple of weeks a year doing outreach work somewhere. India is obviously close to me because there's a lot of need there with 1.2 billion people, a lot of whom don't have access to care, as well as it being the land of my heritage.
Yeah, and what are some of the more tragic cases you've looked at and had to work on, and what were some of the results from those?
So in India, and not just India, but around the world, children's eye care is often neglected. Children don't vote, don't usually have an income, and so they're often neglected. And in India, sadly, there's quite a few kids who never got vaccinated for measles. And we take that for granted in the U.S. Most of the time. I know there are some crazy people here and there, but most of the time we take it for granted. And but you see, you know, these diseases leap out of the old textbooks. You know, measles can wreck your cornea. It can just cause aggressive scarring and blood vessel invasion of the cornea. And that's just devastating to see in a child. Vitamin A deficiency, another thing that, you know, again, we take for granted in terms of nutrition, but a lot of kids, you know, don't have, you know, are undernourished in India and don't have sufficient vitamin A, and that can also damage the eye, both the front and the back of the eye. And then simple things like fighting with sticks. You know, kids like to play, and that's normal and that's good. But you know, when you're fighting with, you know, sticks, which can be sharp, you know, it's probably best to make sure your child has eye protection or, you know, guards the eye. And so I had a kid a few years ago in Pune who had lost one eye from stick fighting. Just that eye had to be taken out before I even met him. And then the other eye had severe corneal damage. He was 10 years old. All he could see was light. You know, basically he was in a blind school, you know, very distraught that, you know, his future hopes were pretty much done for. Unfortunately, in India, there's a lack of corneal donor tissue. When you pass on, you can donate your eyes, and unfortunately, there's a substantial shortage of donor corneal tissue in India. And so we brought in an artificial cornea. It's made in Boston, actually, and we brought in an artificial plastic cornea to help this young boy. We removed his diseased cornea, put in the artificial cornea, and essentially restored him back to almost normal vision, to where he could go to normal school and carry on with his studies. And so that's the kind of smile, that is priceless.
Yeah.
See that kind of impact. And I'm fortunate to be in a profession where, I can be an instrument of God, because this isn't really just about me, right? I'm just doing the surgery, but somebody donated their plastic cornea that they made. Or here in America, somebody donated their eye that I can use their donor tissue for. And so I'm really just a vehicle for helping bring all the elements and pieces together to make sight a reality for patients in distress. And making that kind of impact, it's just the day after surgery is the best day of the week for me, when you get to take the patch off and see somebody smile. That's just, there's no feeling like it.
Yeah, I can imagine. That makes your life so much easier.
So absolutely. That's what makes everything else worth it,
Yeah. So let's turn to your personal side. I know, your childhood went through very quickly, and you're an adult, have a profession, and you have a career and so forth. So on the hobby side, what's your favorite hobby? How do you relax? What else do you do in life?
I love photography, and Utah is a fantastic place for photography and hiking. We have more national parks than any other state, and so there's so many places to see within a day's drive or even just within a 20-minute drive that are just beautiful and relaxing. Getting out into nature and seeing beautiful landscapes is something I really like to do. In the wintertime, I did try my hand at snowboarding, but a few years ago I broke my shoulder, so I've recovered from that, but I haven't worked up the nerve to try that again. But snowshoeing and tubing are great pastimes here in the winter. I also love movies and travel and just talking to kids and students.
And I know we both recently went to India to do ink talks. So I assume you get called quite often to come and be an inspirational speaker or motivational speaker at events. And any favorite places you've gone to?
Thank you. MR, you were the one who arranged that invitation, so thank you for that. The Ink Talk in India was one of the best conferences I've ever been to. It, I guess, grew out of TED India a few years ago, and this Ink conference that was organized by you and Lakshmi in Mumbai was just a fantastic group of fascinating people at the top of their game from all walks of life. So I really, really enjoyed that. I have had the opportunity to speak to high school kids and college kids and medical student classes. I'm actually going to Caltech this afternoon. I'll be speaking with Caltech engineers tomorrow. And so every time I do one of these things, I always learn so much more than I think I teach. And so it's just really been a good opportunity to meet people at the top of their game or the future stars, in terms of young people, the future stars who are really going to move their respective fields forward. And I've really enjoyed that.
And so the other thing is, I know you're going to do the Caltech thing, and I guess there's some good news in your personal life as well. You want to tell us who the lucky woman is?
Sure. I just got married about 2 months ago. Her name is Esther. She works here in our Department of Ophthalmology here at the university. Esther's a wonderful lady who handles our communications. She's our communications director and does our PR and website and fundraising and grant writing for philanthropic development. And so she's also in ophthalmology, helping keep the lights on, by all of these philanthropic donations that really enable us to do outreach and research and humanitarian activities.
Fantastic. Congratulations. And so are
Thanks.
You taking off for a delayed honeymoon soon?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to New Zealand on Friday, so yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's
we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's a great way to kind of take off some time and be in a beautiful place. So
I've never been
best.
To South Island of New Zealand before, so it's,
yeah.
I hope to see some Lord of the Rings scenery.
Absolutely, we were there a couple of years ago, and like I said, it's a Kodak moment after another every second you're there. So if you have a digital camera, make sure you have a lot of memory.
Yep, absolutely.
So fast forward, you're now married, you're on your honeymoon. Fast forward 14 years, you have a child who's 14 and comes to you and says, "Dad, I want to be a doctor." How are you going to react to that?
Well, as far as being a doctor, I would absolutely be supportive. I would be very happy if someone was interested in medicine, because I think it's a very noble and wonderful field and way of being part of society. I think you may have meant to ask if they wanted to go to medical school at age 14.
Right.
And that kind of path doesn't start at 14. It really has to start much younger. And so if Astrid and I have talked about this, and if we had a kid who was, very precocious and wanted to move faster than normal, I think we would be supportive. We would not push that or force that. My parents did not do that to me. But if a kid had the aptitude and the talent and the inner grit, because to do this you really do need a lot of grit to handle obstacles that come your way, I think that would be great, but that's not something that I would I really have to be cautious here, because I don't want to make a kid feel inadequate if they don't repeat this or exceed this. They should be able to follow their own path and passion and flower in whichever way that they're best suited for. I guess if they wanted to do medicine early, I would encourage it, but if they wanted to do something else, that would be fine too.
Great. So Bala, you've been such an inspiration to all of us in the Indian American community, and just proud to that you're doing this, we want to wish you nothing but the best, and have a great honeymoon and relax and come back, and we'll be in touch with you.
Thank you very much.
Super.
I really appreciate being on the program, and I will hope to see you soon, Amar.
Great. So thank you, everyone. This is Amar Rangaswamy signing off. Our show today is produced by Monica Patel. The theme music is by our very own Rina Ismail. The interlude music is by Jahan Shah. So long, everyone.
Bye.